Welcome back to M&A Access. My name is Ekaterina, and today we are here in Chicago for the summer conference, and I am joined by Gina Luna. Gina, thank you so much for visiting me today. How is summer conference treating you so far?
Thank you for having me. It's great. Always great to be here and see new faces as well as so many old friends that we bump into here.
Mm-hmm. And Chicago.
I know.
Also.
Great, especially this time of year.
Yes, yes. So share a little bit about your background first and your role at Genesis Park and GP Capital Partners.
Sure. So my background, I'm from Texas. I've been in Texas my whole life and in Houston for a long time. And the first part of my career, I spent 22 years at JP Morgan. So always on the commercial and investment banking side of the business, but had a great opportunity to do lots of different things within JP Morgan, and loved all of my time there. And then I left in 2016 and have been doing, some investing and advisory work, joined some public company boards, after leaving JP Morgan, and then came together with two great partners, in 2021 and, founded GP Capital Partners, which is the SBIC fund platform under the Genesis Park family. And we're now on our second SBIC fund. And again, I'm one of three managing partners, and we have a great investment team of about 10 people.
Mm-hmm. But I know that you've had a career across banking, investing, board leadership, and civic leadership. Is that correct?
I have, yes, I have definitely done all of those things. And, you know, in many ways, most of the civic leadership has been sort of business civic leadership. So, an example of that would be, like chairman of the Greater Houston Partnership, which is a big sort of business led, business focused organization, for the Houston community. So, and then I've done, work on several, public and private companies. Of course, many of our own portfolio companies, but also some boards completely unrelated to Genesis Park. Most of those were boards I was on before we formed our fund. And then, some important to me, nonprofit and foundation boards. So, it's been a great privilege to do all those things. Mm-hmm.
So how did that path shape the way you look at the lower middle market companies today?
Well, I'm fortunate again to have worked with, you know, big corporate entities, public companies, and all the way down to, what we call lower middle market, which is privately held businesses, you know, roughly with EBITDA between 3 and 15. That's where we focus today. And so there's a lot of fun and a lot to learn in working with businesses of all those sizes. But what I find the most rewarding and the most fun is where we get the chance to work very directly with the business owners and the, you know, often the founders and the management team. And it's, you know, in many cases, the people who actually built that business, or maybe someone in their family built that business. And they're the decision makers. So they really, really value the advice of their trusted partners. And so to get the opportunity and the privilege to be one of those partners that really helps them take the business to the next level, I think is, you know, to me, that's a really great part of this business.
Mm-hmm. What is it about lower middle market that makes you so interested in?
Well, I mean, I think the diversity of businesses that you interact with in the lower middle market is, you know, endless in terms of what we see and the kinds of businesses we get to learn about. But they're run by great people who take a lot of pride in the business that they've built or that they've bought. And there's amazing upside. You know, think about so many of the brand name businesses that we all know today started that way, and they have grown up to be sort of household names. So I just see a ton of potential and a lot of interesting work to be done in companies of that size.
Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned before, we are currently at the summer conference. And your summer conference panel focuses on sourcing, competition, and the path to liquidity. What is making the lower middle market deal environment so competitive right now?
I think a lot of things. Clearly, there is a lot of capital available chasing attractive deals, you know, both from a acquisition perspective and equity, but also the financing component and the different, you know, debt capital sources. And I think, you know, it continues to be a very attractive part of the market where you can still find value and create value. Mm-hmm. And it is, I think, less transparent and less sort of market-driven in the same way that, you know, corporate entities are. And so I think that continues to attract you know, buyers and capital from a number of different sources. And I think there's a lot of people like me that just think it's a really fun part of the market, and it continues to be a place where opportunity exists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how has the deal sourcing changed over the last few years?
You know, I don't know that it's necessarily changed. I think one component of deal sourcing, what I see is, you know, there's more, for example, independent sponsors have proliferated as a model for pursuing lower middle market deals over the last several years. Once upon a time, we kind of called them, you know, like fundless sponsors, and it was certainly not as popular or as widely accepted as a way to get a transaction done as it is now. But for many investors, that's become sort of their model of choice in terms of pursuing deals and you know, how they think about them being structured most opportunistically. So, you know, developing relationships with independent sponsors, with funded sponsors, with referral sources, I think that all continues to be really important. But I just think there's more deals being driven, certainly to us as a capital provider, through that channel than there was, you know, certainly 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. In such a competitive industry, like we mentioned before, how do you stand out to business owners and management teams?
You know, I think this is a relationship business, and I think ultimately your actions and your reputation and your track record speak for themselves. So, you know, we can say a lot of things about ourselves. I think it's much more important what the market says about us. What do the portfolio company leaders that we have invested in say about us, the partners that we've invested with? And so, you know, again, we focus on being consistent in how we make investments, being consistent in how we treat our portfolio companies and how we help them through, you know, various iterations and cycles of their business. And over time, you know, that becomes your reputation, and people ultimately do business with someone they trust. And so, at the end of the day, I think that's what we're doing every day, is building trust and a track record of being capable and credible and making good decisions, but also doing what we say we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. And what is something that you look for in a lower middle market company before getting serious about an investment?
For us, it always starts with the people first. Do we feel like they're capable, credible, transparent? Do we have the right alignment? Do we believe in, you know, what they say, and does the company sort of reflect the values and the culture that they talk about? So all of those things, I think clearly after we get comfortable with the people, then we really dig into the business and the opportunities and the risks and the growth levers and all of those things. For us, the people involved, both the owners or the management team, but also, you know, the other parties that are part of the investment group, if it's more than just us, if we don't get past that first step of feeling like we've got the right people, we generally don't go past that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Speaking of that, what some of the biggest red flags that you are looking for that might pause during evaluation?
you know, again, it's, if you're feeling like, I always, think about the opportunities we've looked at where the more you learn, the less you like it. And, you know, some people put together, I think there's a saying about, is it a good story or is it a good storyteller? We need to make sure it's a good story. And so, you know, just because you get a beautiful deck and a fast talking banker or sponsor or whatever, we need to be able to dig a lot deeper and validate the things that we thought we liked initially versus, you know, I can certainly think of instances where you start to peel back the onion and sort of with each layer you uncover, oh, that's not exactly what we thought, or this is a surprise, or we learned something about the people involved. And I think our standards are pretty high. So, you know, we tend not to, there's certain things we're just not going to sacrifice on. And so we often have been, you know, in the middle of a deal pursuit process or in due diligence. And we just say, you know what, this is not a right one for us. And I think you have to be willing to make that call at whatever stage you find something that, is just inconsistent with your expectations, or, you know, for lack of a better word, sort of gives you that gut feeling that this is just not right. Mm-hmm. And I generally am inclined to follow that instinct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how do you evaluate whether a company is ready for growth capital or not?
Well, I think there's the dynamics of the business that dictate, is it ready? Not only is it ready for growth capital, but is it ready for the kind of growth capital that we provide? Mm. I mean, we're debt centric. So some companies certainly, you know, need capital, but what they need is equity. A company has to have a certain profile to be ready to take on debt capital. It can be certainly advantageous to them and to the owners, and then it's non-dilutive, but, you know, there's a whole set of things that come with taking on leverage. And so we want to make sure the company financially is positioned to do that. And then I think you have to, certainly in change of control transaction, are the owners really ready to step away or to be in a different role? And I think, you know, it takes a long time to sort of figure that out. And that's part of our pursuit process and part of the diligence process is, are they sort of emotionally in the place where they are going to be happy, you know, in a very different position with this company than they were pre-transaction. Mm-hmm. So I think those are all things. But I would say generally most of the deals that we look at, it's not a spur of the moment decision. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this and sort of positioning for it.
Mm-hmm. So with your very big experience in this industry, what is one deal that stand out the most to you that you worked with?
Oh my goodness. One deal.
And you don't have to name any names.
I mean, I think it's so fun when you can be a part of a home run deal. So those are naturally, I can think of ones that stand out to me because they were, in fact, the home run where we were fortunate to have the opportunity to invest in a company that was started by a very young management team for entrepreneurs that started the business when they were in college.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, built it through sweat and ambition and just incredible work ethic. And we invested. They were wildly successful. They were acquired by a much bigger company. And I think two things that made that particularly exciting, the founder that we backed became the CEO of the much bigger company, which is incredible reflection of his leadership and his ability. But a lot of people, young people, made life-changing money in that transaction. So it's hugely fun and satisfying to be a part of that. You know, I can also think about and have learned a lot from transactions that, you know, have been difficult, where we've gone through very difficult situations. and had to do some hard things. But to watch a company come out the other side of that is also incredibly rewarding, because at the end of the day, you know, by sticking with that company and helping them through that, you saved people's jobs that mm-hmm. support their families. And so, you know, that's creates a lot more gray hair, but it also feels good to be a part of helping somebody through a very difficult time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'll choose more of the former than the latter if given the choice.
So going back to your panel, your panel description mentions partnering with independent sponsors to source deals.
Mm-hmm.
What role are independent sponsors playing in today's market?
Oh, they're driving a ton of deal flow. I think they're incredibly important in terms of transactions being done in the lower middle market. I don't know the statistic, but of the change of control transactions that we see in our pipeline, certainly more than half are driven by independent sponsors, and you know, as opposed to the other half being funds that are lower middle market funds. And then we also do direct deals where there's not a sponsor involved. But I would say of the deals that include a sponsor, they're more than half, again, in our part of the market. And I think there's a lot of very experienced investors, even people who had funds in the past and have chosen to switch to an independent sponsor model and sort of do their fundraising deal by deal. For various reasons, I think in many cases they find it to be more economically advantageous. I think they like the flexibility of not being bound to a fund structure. And they don't have the disadvantage anymore. I think at one point, probably a seller would have been reluctant to choose an independent sponsor over a funded sponsor, maybe for a you know, when they're choosing an LOI. I just don't think that necessarily exists so much anymore, because so many independent sponsors have great track records. They have great references. They have a lot of experience. And in many cases, they're pursuing a very specific thesis or sector where they have really relevant experience. And so the founders or the sellers can appreciate how much value they're going to add. And so it sort of differentiates them in the bid process. So they're a big part of who we spend time with. We really work hard to develop good relationships and to be responsive and consistent, so they know what we're looking for in terms of criteria of the investments that we will make, and that we're a good partner to them.
Mm-hmm. But where can independent sponsor deals get complicated?
Just like all deals, at every step. I think it's safe to say that the independent sponsor universe is incredibly varied in terms of their experience, their track record, how they operate. So choosing the right ones is really, really important. So for us, it's a very high bar to do a deal with an independent sponsor when it's their first deal. I won't say we never do it, but it is a very high bar for us. We're generally looking for people that can at least demonstrate a little bit of track record working together, because usually it's, you know, it's a group of people. Sometimes it's just one, but often it's a group of people who have come together. And so, again, you know, they often bring a very specific set of experience or background that's relevant to the company they're buying. But different than, for example, a private equity fund, it's not always clear how much capital they're going to be able to raise and where it's coming from. And, you know, do they have the same sort of parameters around exit or the same expectations around exit, because they're not held to the fund life that a funded sponsor is. So I think it's all about really getting to know them as a partner, what drives them, what are their objectives, and making sure that there's alignment and clear expectations before you enter the deal.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about value creation a little bit now. What are the most realistic ways to create value in lower middle market companies?
So I think there's a whole list of the obvious ones that we always see, you know, in every sim. They go through the growth levers of the value creation plan. And, the common ones are we're going to increase marketing spend to drive more, you know, volume or revenue. We're going to find cost synergies or savings or margin improvement. We're, you know, going to make acquisitions. So I think, I don't know that there is, you know, a best one or a most common one. What we really look for is, are they tangible and are they credible? And always on paper, they sound great and they sound very easy to execute. And the reality is, in practice, if it was that easy, it would have probably already been done in the business. I mean, that's the... So we really dig in to try to understand not just what is the value creation strategy, but what are the tactics that are going to drive that. And you know, certainly growing the top line and growing EBITDA are something we're always focused on at the highest level. But more importantly, how are you going to do that? And we tend not to base our investment decisions on this notion that there's going to be this huge margin expansion. It's great if that happens, but we sort of tend to discount that as a starting point. And we're really thinking about, how are you going to improve and grow this business? And in many cases, it's about, you know, adding professionalization to the business. I can think of, you know, a common one that you hear about is we're going to go through an ERP transition, which certainly, you know, a system conversion that sort of brings the company to the next level can absolutely add value, but it can also destroy value.
Oh.
Because it's difficult and they're not, you know, generally smooth. And so I think you got to ask a lot of critical questions about value creation and then convince yourself that the people that are going to be charged with doing that have the ability. Again, it's not easy. If it was easy, it would already have been done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now I want to hear a story from you. Have you seen a business where preserving culture was just as important as improving operations?
Absolutely. I mean, I think culture is so fundamental to what makes companies successful. And I do think when, particularly when there's a change of control and or a desire to take a company in a different direction or they're making a big acquisition, you know, messing up that culture is a risk. And so you've got to be mindful about that. And I think to be mindful about changing the culture, you first have to understand and appreciate it. And I generally am a believer that culture starts at the top. So the leadership is really important to that. And if you're making dramatic changes to the leadership, then I think you have to be especially thoughtful about, you know, what's that going to do to the culture. But particularly in companies where relationships are so important, and I'm really talking about client relationships, that culture translates externally as well. And so I can certainly think of companies where, you know, changes happened too fast, or we didn't have the right people leading change, and you clearly start to see the cracks in the culture. Once you break it, it's hard to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're also part of the Women of AM&A Fireside Conversation. Is that correct?
Yes. I stop later this afternoon.
So what does building a legacy mean to you at this stage of your career?
It's a great question. I think it's about, for me, as it relates to Genesis Park, it's about, you know, building our firm and positioning it to be successful and to continue to grow and thrive when I'm not around to be a part of it or to be involved in the day to day. And so making sure we're building and empowering the right team of people who will do that, you know, beyond the time that I'm there or I'm in the sort of in the driver's seat with my partners. But even beyond our firm, to me, the legacy is about the people that you have the opportunity to impact or influence or help in their careers. And that can be, you know, partners, it can be people in portfolio companies, but at the end of the day, that's the fun part of what we do, is getting to work with all these different kind of people with different backgrounds and different ambitions and help them get to the next level. And so, you know, that's, it's an honor to be able to do that. And it's a great, opportunity to have impact. And so I don't actually spend a lot of time thinking about legacy, but, if I'm saying, what do I want my legacy to be? That's what I would answer, is about, you know, sort of making things better for other people and building for the future.
Mm-hmm. And you've held leadership roles in banking, investing, business, and all in the Houston community.
Yeah, I have always lived in the Houston community, and sometimes my roles have been local, sometimes broader than that. But mm-hmm. yes, I have lived in Houston for about 30 years.
So what leadership lesson has stayed with you the most?
You know, I'd love to tell you that it's some brilliant lesson. I think it's really, really simple. I think it's, you know, hold yourself to a very high standard and do what is right, not what is easy. And the best leaders I know do it by example, and they do the small things really well, and they do it very consistently. And when I say the small things, it's like surrounding yourself with really smart people, training and teaching them, and then empowering them. It's things like being grateful and telling people that you're grateful. So it's, I wish there was a magic formula. I don't think it is. I think it's pretty basic.
Mm-hmm. And what advice would you give to women building careers in M&A, private equity, or finance?
I would say don't limit yourself. I think there is tremendous opportunity for men and women. I think it's a great, fun career path. I think it is absolutely possible for women. That's what I always want people to know, is, you know, I had a family, I have a family, I've had a great rewarding career that I've loved. And I'm pleased to say that I've been able to juggle all that in a way that I think has been a positive for my family, but also a positive for sort of my quality of life and being energized about what I do every day. So some days are hard, and it does take a lot of organization and balance and all that, because it's demanding, but it's also rewarding. So, you know, remember, on the hard days, there are also really good days.
And how can the M&A industry do a better job developing diverse leadership?
I mean, I think it's just incumbent on all of us to be focused on the people around us. And I'd like to say the diversity should happen naturally. You know, there's a talent in all different kinds of people. And so creating opportunities and then making sure, again, I think the most important thing about developing people, especially early in their career, but not exclusively early in their career, is giving people candid, constructive feedback in real time. Like, you don't need to wait till it's time for a formal review. We all learn in the moment. And so I want people around me to give me feedback when they see that I did something well or when I could have done something better. And I think it's my obligation to do the same. And I feel like when I take the time to give somebody some feedback or coaching, I'm only doing that because I think it will help them. And I want them to take it that way. And I feel the same way. I think it's a favor when somebody tells you when you could have done something better.
So Gina, before we wrap up this episode, I want to know your opinion. Where do you think lower middle market M&A is headed over the next few years?
Oh, I think it's, the land of opportunity. I mean, I think there's going to be, it's like everything in the world today. It's fast moving. We're all figuring out how to use the latest tools and resources. The world will continue to evolve. There will continue to be challenges, some of the same challenges, some of new challenges, but there's a ton of smart, energetic, enthusiastic people that do this. And I think they'll continue to make things happen, to innovate, and it drives opportunity. So I'm very bullish.
And what should investors do to stay competitive?
I think stick to your discipline, be true to, you know, the values of your fund or your firm, and continue to build relationships. I still think this is very much a relationship business. Everybody's money is green. And so you differentiate yourself in other ways by being helpful, responsive, credible, thoughtful, all of those things. You know, again, it's the small things, mm-hmm. but cumulatively and over time, I think they're differentiators.
Mm-hmm. Gina, thank you so much for visiting me today. I hope you will enjoy the rest of our summer conference here in Chicago. We have a closing reception coming up, which will be fun. And yes, thank you so much for listening to the latest episode of M&A Access. And until next time, stay tuned.
These kinds of conversations are happening all the time. We'd love for you to join in, whether it's through our monthly webinars, our biannual conferences, or our CIMA certification, and then we have our chapter events across the nation all year round. You can find out more at amaaonline.com. Until then, see you next time.